It's a few minutes after the hour, so I thought we would we'd get started, if that's okay with people. This session on alternative university models of scholarly publishing, I think, is the official title. I'm Stuart Cheever. I'm a professor of computer science here at Harvard, and was asked to facilitate this conversation, probably in a different role as the chair of a university committee on scholarly publishing. Peter Suber was also supposed to be here to facilitate. Unfortunately, he had a medical issue arising for yesterday, so he was not able to make the conference. And I can tell you, no one is sorrier about that than me, because he is really the world expert when it comes to these issues of models of scholarly publishing. So I won't be able to duplicate his expertise by any means, but fortunately I don't have to, because you're all here to fill in any gaps in my own knowledge. Maybe we'd start just by going around the room to find out who everybody is, because a lot of faces I don't recognize, and people from different areas, so just like to figure out who people are. So maybe we'll just kind of work front to back, kind of in raster scan order. Start with you, Terry.
I'm Terry Martin. I'm the librarian at the law school here.
Dolores Good, professor of psychology, Lesley University.
I'm Henry Shepard. I'm a rising senior at Brown University.
Brendan Hickey. I'm a senior at Brown University.
I'm Matt Cowell. I helped develop the International Genetic Engineering Machine Lab this year.
I'm Robin Gaynor-Cowell. I just graduated from Brooklyn College with a degree in math and computer science.
I'm Carrie Peterson. I'm the director of the Gay Library at the Fletcher School of Tufts.
Yeah, cool. I'm an astrophysicist at the Harvard Smithsonian and also a fellow from the
Witzel Cardi. I'm executive director of the Melton Foundation, also senior editor of Innovations, Technology, Governance, and Globalization, the journal published by the press.
I'm Quogo, and I'm a founder of a company called Spaith, and we're building knowledge management tools.
Frank Catanzaro. I'm the director of Cyber Futures for UN University Global Foresight Network.
Bruce McHenry. I've been involved in this issue since I was an undergraduate. Sitting in computer science classes thinking about, God, these tools we're learning about have got to transform the way we're educated. Totally being smashed in any kind of lecture situation like this almost all the time. And we still have it. Hopefully, of course, we're by and large, it's still mostly junk. 80% of it. There's 20% that really is good that they can use. And the tools aren't there to really change the conversation. And I don't think the tools are there that there really is going to be an awareness of what's possible.
I'm Robin Peake. I'm a professor at Simmons College. I'm an old war veteran.
And I also write a column for information today called the Custom Publishing.
I'm Blaise Friedman. I'm a summer web intern at the
Harvard Law Magazine. John Stevenson of the IT department of Harvard University Press.
I'm Michael Fisher. I'm also from Harvard University Press. I'm editor-in-chief.
I'm Jeff Bernhard. I'm editor of the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology.
I'm Brian Crawford. I'm the senior VP for the Journals Publishing Program at the American Chemical Society. Also involved in the Transplantation Association of American Chemists.
I'm Ben Meeks, the staff here at the American Center and member of the First
Group. John Bill Banks from Creative Commons, where I work on the Science Commons Project. Open access to digital information is one of the three elements of our work, and I am happy to be here.
I'm Greg Price, an undergraduate for computer science at UNT.
I'm Ben Decker. I'm also a Harvard College student and also one of the founders of a new academic journal on interactive media.
I'm Xander Lee. I'm also a rising senior at the college, and I work with Ben on the Redo.
I'm Bob Pryor, executive editor of the MIT Press, Stewart's Book Publishing.
I'm Scott Lipinski. I'm the Digital Resources Librarian over at Harvard Medical School, and I'm very, very interested in open access.
I'm Will Waiting from Northeastern University Library System.
I'm Rafa Rodriguez Prieto. I'm an assistant director.
I'm Jim Lance, editor and director of Tamari Press. And several months ago, I made the mistake of recommending to the owner of the press that we grant a contract to an author using the Creative Commons licensing arrangement. She said, "What, are you crazy?" And I told her about this conference, and she said, "You go there and set those people straight."
Back off. Mark Celia, I'm general counsel for Elsevier.
I'm John Clifford, senior fellow at Berkman Center, and work in digital identity.
I'm David Boulder, the editor of OnTheCommons.org and co-founder of Public Knowledge.
I'm Greg Gordon, president of SSRN, Social Science Research Network.
I'm Ralph Gambry, and I also work with Social Science Research Network.
And Juan Carlos Martin, WPG professor from the Open Doctrine of Italy, and I'm a founder of the Center for Internet Society.
Michael Yan, professor of information systems from the University of Oklahoma.
Jessica Cashton, research program development at Harvard Law School.
Tim Nguyen, counsel for science commons.
Derek Van Bauer, law professor at the University.
Excellent. Thank you all very much for coming. So, quite a diverse group we have. Faculty, lawyers, people from various publishing enterprises, other companies and nonprofits, lots of stakeholders here. So I don't want to talk too much. I just thought I would raise the general topic. It's not even clear to me what the questions are, but to raise the general topic and then see what people have to say about it. The top, of course, is alternative models of scholarly publishing, which begs the question, alternative to what? Alternative, presumably, to the traditional model of scholarly publishing. It's a little tricky to say exactly what that model is, because there are various things that get published. There are books. Journal articles, conference proceedings, technical reports, all kinds of, I'm sure I'm forgetting some things. They may have different properties due to the effects, the correct or ideal mode of publication if such even exists, on the one hand. And on the other hand, the goals may differ for these different kinds of publishing. It seems clear to me, although others may feel free to disagree, seems clear to me that the goal of scholarly publishing, what makes scholarly publishing distinct from other kinds of publishing, is that the originators of the content have as their goal the widest possible distribution subject to economic sustainability of the publishing system and subject to the utility of the published material for the readership. So, the reason I put that last in is because if you merely, for instance, said that the publishing system would be a free-for-all, every author for him or herself try to get people to read it, that of course might enable wide distribution. You could just put things up on your web page, and it might be economically sustainable in the sense that those people with web pages would be able to do it. But of course, what are readers to do? I mean, you know, there's no filtering, there's no clue about how to manage this undifferentiated mass of stuff. There was a question.
Yeah, I think you need to add one more motivator to the product, and to see a wide distribution, but to what end? you know, there's political land, tenure banking, there's advancement of the field, there's personalized advisement, there's turf protection. If it truly is in advance of the field, then it opens up an entirely new dialogue about alternatives.
So why is that? Why is that one special?
Well, because publication. I'll tell you the example from my own work. We work with UN University, which has probably the worst bureaucratic roadblock system to
which university?
United Nations University towards publication. You put something into the system, and you're lucky. Fast track, best case scenario, 6 or 7 years later, it gets published. And that's before. That's after, of course, peer review, which is a whole other process. So this discourages the unusual ideas, the outliers, the research that might be important but not recognized, and the emerging model of publishing towards that end is open source research, which bypasses, I mean, and here you get a lot of nervous reactions, bypasses the peer review process. And it publishes ideas in advance of research to attract peer communities interested in the same research, and you build a momentum towards what no one researcher could accomplish. It's happening in many fields, biology, physics, chemistry. Open source research is becoming a recognizable phenomenon.
So you're using the term, be a little bit careful about terms, using the term open source
in the sense that open access is used?
Open
source as a community model. Open source can be used to create software.
Okay.
The same community model can be used towards publishing or towards research. Or
so this is not the sense of open access, the term open access is used.
Well, it's related in the sense
related,
that
yes.
the notion is that it's not proprietary until it's published, which is the traditional approach to research now. You guard your research until it goes through that final peer review, and now it's published, and you have your star in the publishing heavens.
So you're saying that's not open access, or that?
But that's the current model.
Right.
And the open source model of research is, well, dang that, we're interested in advancing the field.
So you put things up, you let people comment on it, you let people collaboratively develop it, and so
yeah.
As a publisher.
Well, as a research mechanism, and that eventually then ends up as a published product.
And what is the published product?
Well, the result of the research.
So if it would, so you have the initial, I'm just trying to understand the process. It sounds a little bit like PLOS One.
PLOS One does do peer review, though. They verify the validity of the science. But I mean, I'm going to channel Peter real quick.
Yes.
Access is an access model, not a review model or a business model. Elsevier could go open access and actually allows you to put, you know, papers in to the public domain. Access is digital, online, free of charge, and free of most copyright restrictions. So I think it's important to sort of tease apart
right.
The business models, the access models, and the review models, and make sure about what we're talking about when we're talking about it.
Right. So, but I think to be fair here, this is another approach, an alternative to scholarly publishing.
I'm channeling Peter because that's what Peter always says to me
right.
when I say things like that. So I'm just
right.
Reversing my normal role.
Right. So fair enough. I take your point. Hopefully we'll come back to this because it's an interesting question as to whether peer review, which is part of both traditional publishing and many open access models, is problematic, or where places where it's problematic.
Stuart, I've looked at some of the open source research, and although it's not always consistent, there is an implication that I'm offering this up to the community and it can be modified. Whereas with open access, you're supposed to keep the version control more fit when it's fixed to the authorship, whereas in open source, like open source software, there seems to be more, quite a bit more liberalness about putting this out and letting it go further.
Well, I think the further distinction is that in open source research, it's about the community dynamic, not about the published product.
Right.
The the open source.
It sounds like a research method as opposed to publishing.
It's a research method that looks at different modes of publishing and shuns the traditional track of peer review and keeping it proprietary. In lieu of being able to attract communities of interest that can advance and accelerate the research.
So there's this research model which necessarily is going to go along with certain kinds of down the road publishing models. The other models that typically get talked about are open access as an alternative to. So I didn't say what's the traditional model. The traditional model is a model in which access is limited in some way. That is to say, subscribers only subscribers are given access to materials, and the subscribers are paying fees to a publisher. The publisher might be a commercial publisher, might be a scholarly society, might be the journal itself run as an independent organization.
So you could put it in another way simply, which is that the traditional model that you mentioned is that the subscribers pay for the access to a large community, which is often quite large.
Right.
A certain large universities, for example.
Right.
But excluding this new sort of grassroots communities and network.
There's lots of experiments going on in all sorts of ways.
What?
One way or another. Research today,
my point is that one way or another, somebody needs to get excluded. Because if you can't, there needs to be the capacity to exclude someone.
No.
If you can't exclude.
No,
I'm talking about their traditional model.
That's the only business model.
No. I'm describing the traditional model. It's a descriptive claim because. Because in the traditional model, the funds for running the journal come from getting subscribers to pay you for the privilege of not being excluded. And if you have no...
In the traditional model is those journals such as Nature and perhaps our own journal Cell, which are high circulation, high subscription numbers, with lots of personal subscriptions, et cetera, which actually have the lower cost, so it's not exactly the way you describe it. Restriction. You were talking about the model being about restricting access.
I don't think that that's inconsistent with the structure of Nature itself.
I think what Mark's trying to clarify there is that the broader the circulation, in the traditional model when it was print, there were multiple revenue streams, not only a subscription base, also, for example, paid advertising. So maximizing circulation, maximizing access was also a goal and remains a goal of the traditional model. It's not only limited access.
But it remains the case you want to maximize circulation.
Correct.
Paid access.
For many reasons.
Right. Which is a form of broadening access. And if we're debating the semantics,
but
not necessarily limiting.
It's never been the case that I would go to the website of Cell or another journal that is based on the traditional model and be able to just read all the material, all the articles that are from the latest issue, from last year's issue, and the issue from 5 years ago. So that fact that I can't do that until I pay is about restricting access.
It's about making money.
Perhaps Mark will want to clarify
the business
model.
Perhaps Mark will want to clarify the business model for Cell, where it is actually an example of a journal that has delayed open access. So the restriction is there for a period of time,
correct,
in order to secure the subscriber base and the advertiser base. And then the access restriction is lifted, so there is that broader access. Unfortunately, I guess you were not aware of
it. So that's another hot, but I still think it's current. I mean, it's still restricted.
Correct.
It's a search and watch list around
them. So there are flavors, I think, of access. There's the traditional model, there's the open, completely open from, let's say, born open model. Then there are these hybrid models.
Right. their there, so let me just maybe try one more time and say what the traditional model is. The traditional model is one in which, one way or another, access is limited, at least for a time, to those willing and able to pay. And of course, you're going to want to make that number of people as large as possible and so forth to maximize subscription revenue, advertising revenue, and so forth. But there's some kind of, at some point, the ability to exclude readership. Not making a value judgment here. I'm just open access models attempt to achieve these same goals of wide distribution and economic sustainability, but with different business models by not limiting access to paid subscribers, but somehow making the content available without charge, and they need to recoup whatever expenses there are some other way. They may also go along with changes in the peer review process or not. I think that's really a separate issue, and maybe one we should talk about. And then there's a third topic that gets discussed. So those are sort of open access journals that work that way, probably the best known of which is are the PLOS journals, PLOS Biology and Medicine and so forth. But not exclusively, there are several thousand of them. Finally, another topic that gets discussed when in this general issue of open access or alternative models of publishing is open access archiving of articles independently of the publishing system that's used. That would be authors making available versions, one version or another of their articles unilaterally on their websites or institutional repositories. It may or may not be allowed by the conditions of the typical conditions that journals, journal publishers, mandate for their authors. There may be others I'm interested in, or I'm sure I've missed nuances here. Other topic types of alternatives that people are interested in bringing up at this point. So let me just stop there and see thoughts you have on these models. Yeah.
Well, I would add how you integrate traditional print published output or product with other types of contents or interactions. So let's say that you have a journal, you have an article, you publish that article, but that it can be tied to events. You have author speaking, delivering some of that data, podcast, getting feedback loops, embedded into that. So I think, I guess the point is, journals branching out into multiple channels of dissemination and interaction beyond just a vetted, whether it's peer review or other process to reach that one particular. Leverage that content lots of multiple ways,
right,
around the same time period.
So new alternative types of content, kind of an orthogonal issue from
types. This. Yeah, yeah, right. And the ramifications of that in the digital
multimedia
world. So I mean, we're talking with our journal about how you then can do a webinar with the author related to the published piece. Whether you could have vlog input back from different people, sort of iterative building off of the original published product. which is kind of the inverse of what you were talking about, which is interaction and input leading up to the finished product, and then you can have both, and then you have to give it lots of different channels for doing that kind of thing. I don't know what, how you describe that, but I see that as another form of another kind of publishing model. How, where does the publishing start, where does the publishing end?
I think building off of that, and you mentioned it earlier, the degree of granulation of the product. What is the published product, the book, article, paper, whatever it might be, with Web 2.0, with the semantic web, and a much finer level of granularity, I think the notion of the published product is going to change radically. And typically, I'm looking for, if I'm on a current awareness list of, from a dozen publishers, I'm not going to subscribe to all of those journals. University on Map doesn't subscribe to all of those journals. The only way I have access to those with to even know that there's something of content that I can get out of it is $30 a reprint usually. But with the semantic web and sort of structured content, you have the ability to sort of drill down into those existing products to just that nugget that you want. You know, perhaps there's a micropayment approach to really getting just the piecing together a patchwork of what it is you're really looking for, a research report on existing literature.
Yeah. I think based on the traditional research and communication habits of different disciplines, we're starting to see what you might think of as specialized applications in sort of traditional publishing and then what you might characterize as supplemental material, which doesn't fit neatly into the traditional peer-reviewed article of X numbers of words with a bibliography permitted of the size. So in the humanities, what we're starting to see is that authors will put extended bibliographies on their own websites or ask their library to host those extended bibliographies. Scientists have a very real issue in terms of the research data that supports their findings and where does that go? Does that become part of the proprietary publishing system or is it something that faculty maintain on their own website, an institutional website, because their federal contract requires them to keep that data persistently available for other researchers. So that seems to us that the edges of what constituted communication, scholar communication about a publishable size piece of work is no longer adequately supported by a traditional size box of a peer-reviewed article, and the supplemental material is starting to
So just to summarize so far, I think we've talked about issues of different types of access, how access is determined, different types of content, research data and multimedia and so forth, different approaches to the might think of as the research process that maybe leads up to or maybe is interleaved with the publication. Are there other distinctions that need to get made? Yeah.
I would have to add use to that. Because
Types of use
that are enabled or permitted.
Yeah, and just to follow up on that, enabled or permitted, you mean technically or legally or?
All of the above. I mean, it's one thing to be able to find and access something, but then the question is what can you do with it subsequently?
Right. Yeah.
There's also the issue of maintenance. Where the electronic files are housed, who's responsible for them. For example, I'll use MIT Press as an example, the most people have files, you know, sitting on MIT Press's file servers, that is access, but what commitment does MIT Press have to maintaining those files? Are those files also available on the author's website? or are they in an institutional repository, and how long will we be able to access them?
So, yeah. So, is it an issue of, more generally, of location, or hosting, or
archiving?
So kind of several of these things, maybe. But we, maybe archiving is in general. You know, writ large to talk about these other issues. Yeah.
I'd like to sort of channel Charlie's.
Yeah. Okay.
And be slightly disruptive here.
Excellent.
And thinking about an alternative model and how to think about these things, and just throw out, if you look at something like Second Life and the whole idea of user-generated content, and how you really create a platform, and rather than try to plan something and figure it out top-down, you actually create a number of enabling conditions with people that are going to figure these things out in their own different contexts, and that you have sufficiently rich tools and enable that to happen. And I'd argue that that is sort of the trend where things are going, and that you're going to have business models follow that, and it's going to create a new kind of environment. So it raises a different set of issues.
So it is the case that the scholarly literature is, in a certain sense, user-generated content. That is, the people who are generating the content are the people who are using the content. There's a community of scholars who both generate and read.
But then there's so many ways of implementing that.
Absolutely.
And there are so many different conventions that people could decide upon in terms of what the right should be, the community. You could describe the community, you could monetize the product, you could service, you could have a variety of different ways of doing it. And I just think that when you have,
well, so we've talked about
going digital in the sense that you have the flexibility to do having these experiments. And I think it's going to be more of an emergent property than something to try to sort of psych it out a priori.
So while you're channeling Charlie, or maybe not, you can channel yourself, what direction would you like to see it go?
Well, no surprise, I think that I'm interested in seeing that kind of direction. I think that you need to have a number of different experiments. I think there are a number of different constituencies, and I think that you're going to discover new kinds of business models, new kinds of ways of doing it in the process of exploring these new kind of distribution networks. And I would refer to my friends when I left on the business models, that their business models that accompany that have been a lot of the bottleneck. So I'm going to say, how do you make money? Is it going free? Is it going to make it bust? How do you maintain quality? The reputation systems that can be built, the peer-based reputation system. And part of the theme of this whole conference is, how do you get knowledge beyond the traditional authority models? And how does that, and how do you authenticate credentialized knowledge among the peer network? Very different than the traditional feudal models that we've been living with. So I think one way, you can open it up, and I think that's where the energy is going to be. That's where the creativity is going to be.
John, so I'm going to make two comments. The first is to respond to the last comment, which is exactly the kind of thing Charlie would have said. So points to that. This is what I would argue back against it, which is that scientists, journals started in 1665, the peer review model. This is a very entrenched hierarchical system that resists change much more so than culture broadly. And so while I agree with the idea of experimentation, I also think we can take a lesson from Negroponte last night, which is there are some places where you have to go big or go home. And I think when it comes to getting access to the literature, we have to start thinking more about going big than just doing experiments. We need to do things like cite and preserve. I mean, Ann can talk about this. Libraries and publishers create a citation record that is trackable for hundreds of years. How do you do that in Second Life? What if Second Life goes under because they can't scale over 100,000 contemporaneous users? So we need to deal with some of the realities of the scientific culture in this that don't mesh well with Web 2.0, as much as I would like them to. The other point that I'd make here is that sort of if you go back to Charlie's idea of this conference, it's sort of university, funder, nonprofit, library, how do corporate, how do they interact? And the funders are starting to buy into open access. They seem to understand that if your goal is return on investment, right, whether you're Howard Hughes or Wellcome or the EU or the US government, there's an emergent tide that says that the best way to maximize the return on your investment in research is for research to be disseminated. And when publishers publish studies attacking OA, they make them OA. Kind of ironically, because then they can be published. They don't peer review them and put them behind a firewall. They give them away and they get published all over them. Just like we do. So I mean, we're all sort of even in this. So you know, we've got some costs for open access for buying rights to reader charges. Springer says it's $3,000 an article for the right to put a Creative Commons license on it. It's a data point. And there's going to be a market shakeout as the funders negotiate with the publishers to figure out what it costs to achieve the desired return on investment. So what does university do as a player in that negotiation is the question that I was asking with Charlie in the lead up to this conference. Because the funders are negotiating with the publishers, but the universities are not at the table. They don't have a hand in the poker game, as Charlie would say. Right. MIT, and you can and maybe reveal some of the stuff that's done with MIT's negotiation on the self-archiving amendment, but there is no university negotiation at the level of the EU negotiating with the publishers. And I'm going to stop right there.
Dan, can you say something about that?
You could say what's going on at Harvard, too.
Let's start with MIT.
All
right. Can I just ask a clarifying question?
Sure.
You're talking about the publishers. Are you talking about the scientific field?
So I'm talking about sort of STM is what I know the most about. I mean,
because it doesn't what you're talking about doesn't math to law or poetry.
We work with the law has actually been easier for Creative Commons. We've got about almost 40 journals that use the open access law program now. Law's been quite easy because student boards sort of drive it. Humanities is a very different world. There's a lot of sort of small society publishers in the humanities, and you don't have a funder pays model that's available in most of the humanities, because half of all humanities research is funded by the salary of the professor, not by a grant that funds it. And so, I sort of, you know, you can get into this later. I believe fundamentally that there are services on the semantic web in particular that add value to the findability, integratability, discoverability, and machinability of an article that create much more value than the sort of removal of the raw text from a copyright context.
My only point was that I don't think there's a traditional model.
Publishing, I think, splits into STM and humanities broadly, and it's we have to do some blurring to talk about this at the level Charlie asked us in the conference level. But everything is messy, everything is detailed, and you know, I think the humanities publishing stuff, we have to think about that from a funding perspective. And one of the things we're going to do in the working group this afternoon is talk about how science funding contains infrastructure for storage, preservation, archiving. There is no NCBI for legal articles. And I mean, that might be a role for university that we're going to explore in the next working group. So.
But I do want to get back to Anne to find out about...
I think that the age of this annual meeting is quite interesting in terms of illuminating how recently we have come to appreciate in the university and the academy, however you want to characterize it, what opportunities for scholarly communication are presented by new forms of technology. And perhaps because MIT has the open courseware initiative. MIT faculty have become aware, perhaps more robustly, more widely, more thoroughly, about the constraints that are put on their use of their own work by traditional publishing models of ownership, where in order to be published, you have to assign all of your rights, now and in any future medium ever imagined, in perpetuity and exclusively to a publisher in order to be published. So when MIT faculty went to their publishers to say, I'm doing an open courseware site, I would like to be able to put my own work in my open courseware site, the publishing community, as those of you who were here yesterday, were almost unilaterally said, no, you can't use your own work on your open. Even though it's an isolated instance, even though open courseware said will connect back to you, will give you a perfect citation. So faculty came to the libraries and others at MIT and asked for help with this problem. And so we developed a uniform copyright agreement amendment that faculty could could simply download or keep in their desktops, attached to the standard publishing agreement that is provided to them by their publishing house, and retain the rights that they said they wanted to host their work in OpenCourseWare, to put it up on their own website, to put it in DSpace, which is MIT's institutional repository. And we've had a very interesting series of discussions with publishers as a consequence of the availability of this tool. And there are other institutions, not in conspiracy, but on their own, who are trying to help their faculty in the same way. Stuart has been very active in those conversations here.
So can you say, what is the status of that amendment? Are faculty required to attach
exhorted to attach it?
It's just an option,
faculty,
or?
It is made available to faculty who wish to use it. Mm-hmm. Faculty are supported with legal advice if they choose to use it, which might be something that the Berkman Center could be helpful with here at Harvard.
Did you have a sense for how many faculty are using
it? Yeah, we asked faculty to notify us if they used it and what their success rate was. So I can give you the data to date, knowing that it's imperfect and incomplete. Ironically, we are getting an 80% success rate from commercial publishers and less than 50% from society publishers.
That's interesting. And when people get pushback, presumably get pushback from the publishers, what then happens?
They can call on the services of an IP attorney on the staff at MIT and enter into negotiations. Sometimes the publisher simply refuses to yield. Depending on whether student careers or junior faculty careers are at stake, if who the publisher is, sometimes the author will cave, sometimes the author will take the paper.
So this is an interesting approach. Obviously, the idea is to retain rights to unilaterally make the paper available through open access through MIT, DSpace, or some repository or other. Yeah.
Has there ever been a case where an author has lost a legal fine or a legal sanction due to using their own words, even though they've given away copyright? I'm not aware of one.
Signing over the copyright. Using them contrary to the contract that they've signed and then being found liable for that?
I can't answer that question. I can only tell you that the MIT faculty asked us to pursue this strategy and head down this path, in part because of their desire to share their work more broadly with their colleagues and students. As well in the institute, as well as their research collaborators outside the institution. I do know that there are societies that have come to faculty at MIT and told them to take their articles off their open website, that it was a violation of their agreement, and the faculty have felt obliged to do that. Very often, faculty simply don't even have a copy of the agreement. So they have no idea what they committed to when they assigned the work to the publisher.
Deborah?
I want to give you another example involved in the John Wiley Journal. Christine Borgman at UCLA wanted to put her paper that was being published in the Journal of the American Society of Information Science and Technology inside the eScholarship repository. And she was told by the depository that John Wiley forbade them to accept the paper. She put it on her own website, but she could not put it in the depository itself.
So I need to do some, trying to
just to follow on Anne's point is that we've actually got a little tool out that has the MIT amendment in it, as well as three other amendments, which reserve varying amounts of rights. The idea was to standardize a spectrum of rights that an author could choose to reserve, and ideally to encourage publishers to basically certify that their policy fit with one of them, and to sort of set a baseline, which was compliance with the NIH public request policy. And so that's available to any anybody that has a website that wants to run the widget, it's one line of iframe code that drops it onto your page and lets you run the generator. Basically, you put in the name of the author, the name of the journal, the name of the article, then your institution, print, you get a PDF.
So I'm interested in, we have representatives of various publishers of various types here. I'm interested in their reaction to this kind of approach where rights are retained through amendment of copyright assignments and articles made available that way.
There, the Green Road site run now in the UK is a pretty good listing, I would say, that attempts to do a little bit of what John was going to talk about, just categorizing the question of if you will retain rights or academic use rights that authors are probably allowed to use, as you mentioned. So typically, there's questions about kind of which version is it, not the manuscript, is it some peer review comments that can be issued, and is a variation. But I think actually what's pretty remarkable about that list is, and the purpose for putting that list together was essentially to, my impression was the purpose was to certainly support institutional repository development, and it's not so much as a way of encouraging publishers to sort of revisit this question about authors' use of their own materials for classroom instruction, et cetera, et cetera. And I think, I'm sure it's always the case that you can find extreme examples of one side or the other, but actually I think what's pretty remarkable is that there are so many publishers identified on that list that are shown as green.
But on that list, John Wiley is listed as green, so it's an interpretation of the website for its repository. We took that up to the editorial board and this past fall, and we voted unanimously as a board that had the repository aspect of it. So it's an interpretation of what is a location it's where you can put
your... Right. Interesting. So for instance, my understanding is that Elsevier journals allow people to put articles on their personal website.
At institution.
In their local institution, but not a third-party repository. Is that right?
Well, yes, except that we have worked out arrangements with NIH, or Trust, Howard Hughes, and some others to prevent some of these other activities.
So many publishers allow personal websites, but no other access. So still considered.
There's a lot of very.
They still consider green. I always wondered about that. But you know, what the argument would be for allowing a personal website but not an institutional repository? There's lots of questions. So yeah, here so we'll come around.
This, there was mentioned 94% of the publishers are green, and right. The problem that I have with that list so far is that the editors of the journals aren't aware of the information on that list, and they don't necessarily agree with it. And now that some of them are finding out about it, it might be changed or altered. So I don't think what's on that list is directly relevant in each case.
But counts
as to be reconfirmed with each journal and each society, and hopefully they'll go along with that 94% green access and self-archiving. But I suspect that when things are further worked out, it won't be as positive as it is now.
But what counts as green also on that list is journals that allow making things available open access after an embargo period that they specify, which is...
Yeah, and another thing I want to bring in, another important thing I find kind of troubling about this whole green classification is that many times the publishers will call themselves green, but you cannot use the publisher's PDF. After that embargo period, the author has to somehow find the final version that was submitted and accepted to the publisher and submit their own electronic copy to the archives. And, of course, with many vital tweaks from that, facsimile comes from the author making a couple of corrections. What is the final version that can be generated by the author 6 months later? So that's a good trend.
Yeah.
How is that not just supposed to be?
Well, I don't know. If you look at the Sherpa site, many of these publishers say that you can submit to an electronic repository, but you may not use the publisher's PDF.
So authors, the author's final version.
The author's final version.
Yeah, well, I, I would like to give credit to Elsevier for the changes in their policies. And this website we're talking about, lest there be any mistake, it does not change the contractual relationship between the author and the publisher. It simply is a publisher's policy at a point in time. So in response to pressure from the environment, Elsevier quite wisely, I think, moved from saying we can't put it up anywhere publicly to you can put it up on our website to you can put it up on an institutional website. But because those are publisher policies and not legal relationships, the publisher could just as easily walk backwards in that sequence without permission of the author, and the author could find themselves right back where they started.
Yeah.
So I think we've talked about two themes here. One is about production of knowledge and sort of open source approaches towards that, and then there's a consumption and access aspect. And I think a lot of the debate about access, I think we all have a sense in the room, is that certainly access to a wide range of audiences beyond the scholarly community makes a lot of sense. How do we make it available? And I think there are some experiments with MIT in terms of what's going on, but the real question is, how does the scholarly community, along with the university, make it a systematic change across the institution instead of one-offs or so forth, right? So MIT had an amendment to your copyright agreement and so forth.
One at a time.
One at a time, right? And it's sort of, it's, you know, and so we don't really get to the goal of access. But we think that the sense that I have of this room and of this whole conference. And I think we sort of need to sort of be thinking more systematically, either discipline by discipline, society by society, to present, to show, and to move over. And I mean, the work of John says that even small technological tools can be helpful, but I think we need a much more systematic effort to try.
So given that the topic is of the conference has to do with the university as an institution, one alternative might be working university by university. So maybe I will mention an idea that has arisen here at Harvard along those lines, which is entertaining the notion of having faculty of a school. Harvard's composed of many independent schools, so the work at the level of a school. The fact that the school agreeing to, as a whole, not article by article, but as a whole, grant a license, not exclusive, but limited, non-commercial distribution license to an appropriate entity, in this case, presumably the president and fellows of Harvard College, in all of their scholarly articles. So this would allow all articles by faculty members at that school to be made available in open access.
Would that be the president and fellows having an agreement saying that this is our policy? Is that the president and fellows of Harvard having this policy then? So you assign, you copyright?
So, no, this would be a policy of the faculty of a school. The license would be owned by. You need somebody to hold the license. The natural, in fact, only corporate institution that's around Harvard, it happens to be the so-called Harvard Corporation.
Sure.
So the faculty would, but this wouldn't be a policy of the president fellow. This would be a policy of, say, the faculty of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, the faculty of Harvard Law School, the faculty of Harvard Medical School, or whoever the person faculty. Would grant that license.
So it's basically a negotiating power issue. You're grouping everybody together.
It has many effects, and that's one of them.
Yeah, well, the German Performing Rights Society works that way. You sign up, and anything that you create is immediately, as the act of your membership, controlled by them.
So this is a little different. This is not. You're not signing copyright to President Charles Harvard. Harvard doesn't own the copyright of your work. You retain the copyright. You can assign it to someone else if you would like.
All you're giving is a non-exclusive, limited license of a very particular sort. You keep the copyright, as long as you
want. Wait, so then what does Harvard do with that license? With that?
What? Harvard would make it available in an institutional repository. See, it's kind of ironic. Harvard doesn't have an institutional repository, unlike any other schools in Cambridge.
I'm stuck with the really strong sense of deja vu. I mean, isn't this just a kinder, gentler replay of the recording industry attempting its siege on their business model to protect its inevitable demise through...
I'm not. Who's the recording?
Publishing has their albums, which are their journals.
Okay.
The recording industry had their albums, which were CDs, and they were distributed freely, much to their chagrin.
Oh, I see.
And they said the solution was to get rid of the internet. And that was their first lawsuit. That was. Now, publishing has been laying back and saying, what can we negotiate with these universities? Let's give away as little as we can. You know, we'll make them feel like they got something. When in fact, all I want is one journal. And I'm going to get that one journal in spite of whatever happens with publishing. That journal is going to have every single piece of research across disciplines that I'm interested in. That's
I'm still missing. So you're saying
just so I mean,
you're saying there's a bad guy here.
There's resistance to change. We're still stuck in this. How do we preserve the publishing model with as little change as possible? I'm hearing universities saying we're trying to get this one concession. Hopefully, we get 50% of the societies
right.
Are.
I see. So you're saying this is not nearly enough.
And the technology is going to steamroll. So just as it happened with the recording industry, publishing should get out in front of this wave. Create that one journal for every single researcher. The income.
I've been a little worried about publishers creating a single journal that
does everything.
I'm thinking about the annual price.
Selective dissemination of information based on the semantic. Selective dissemination of information. I don't subscribe to many journals.
Are you going to pay for the dissemination?
My opinion is how to work the business model. It's working with songs right now. The albums are dead. Individual tracks are selling. The business model works there. With semantic web, you may not even need a complete article. You may just need a conclusion. I want that unique journal for me.
So the general point I think you're making is that we should forget about journals. There's an undifferentiated mass of articles. You should be able to buy the articles individually. But
well,
you can buy the articles
individually. That's where going right now.
But you already can't
buy each. It's not in my business model.
Well, it might not be your business model, but it's the copyright owner's business model.
What about
That's what I'm saying. That's what
it's like. Distinction very clearly between editorial and assemblage and the works themselves. It's in the sense that you've got a journal, you've got the editorial function, which is very important and is made in many respects invisible in the old model, and it's potentially very visible at this point as the technology develops. So where's the value actually? Is it in the dissemination or is it in the editorial?
Well, that's a fair question. Where is the value? I'm going to open that up to the audience here.
I mean, isn't a big part of this the fact that to get be respected in the scientific community, you need it published in this particular journal? I mean, you could have just posted all your thoughts online through the semantic web very easily.
Nobody's got
a blog of your research, but no one's going to respect you. So it's the fact that we're kind of tied to these journals anyway is part of the issue.
Is it the journal or the citation indexes? Or is it new scientific work? If you actually get cited, that's what it is.
I'd like to speak to that. I'm a librarian, but I also work closely with the MIT Press at MIT, and I have come to appreciate that journal publishers add a lot of value to the system. They provide the the structure that many faculty need in order to deliver things on time. And in a certain format. So there's a little bit of a discipline that goes on there. Very often, although open source may do away with this, they provide the software environment that makes these processes work effectively. But just as importantly, I think intellectually, what they do is they bundle individual items into the size of aggregations that make for individual productivity on the part of the reader. So think about your own email and how stuff pours into your email, and you sometimes wish people would stop sending you these little one-off things. And when they get aggregated into something that looks like an electronic email newsletter, you think, hallelujah, you know, that kind of bundling has value. So I think there are services that are provided by journals that have emerged over time as being important to the scholarly communication, their values, their services. The question in my mind is, how much should we pay for that? What's the value? And on the front
end. It's interesting that those value added fees you mentioned are all essentially first copy of value.
Yes. Absolutely.
And absolutely. You know, it might be that it makes more economic sense to charge the mechanism that scales by the article as opposed to by the access or by the reader, size of the reader, given that that's where the cut costs scale.
Well, isn't that what TLOS is doing? I mean, they're charging
per
article.
That's right.
Right. And but they have been able to sustain themselves with the original fee that they were charging?
They have sustained themselves. They sustained themselves on the basis of author charges and, you know, subvention from grants.
Plus, it's also a non-profit publisher. Environment Central's on track to break even this year, and Hindawi is profitable. So
yeah.
you need to sort of look at the numbers. But the thing is, Environment Central had to jack their charges up enormously to get them. Hindawi has to do their editing.
Jack their charges up to how much per article?
I think it's like 1,600 per article now.
Okay.
Hindawi is probably able to pull this off because they're in Egypt. They only charge $500 or $600 an article. So that's going to shake out from a business model perspective. I wanted to sort of hit Anne's comments. So we're distributing in Science Commons, as far as we can tell, is the world's largest database in RDF, Semantic Web, for public distribution of content. It's 90% triples. We're over half a billion triples already. We have an open sparkling point. We're doing a lot of this. The provenance of an assertion is the single most important part to a scientist being willing to use the system. And journals provide the provenance of an assertion in a trusted manner in a way that individual real scientists, not technologists, you know, have forced us to integrate. We started thinking in this sort of, you know, big virtual journal, aggregated journal, people make their own virtual journals and blog them. You know, so far, when a scientist runs, you know, maps a gene expression data set into our triples database, and they get back a result and says, well, these are the signal transduction genes involved in Alzheimer's that might be good drug targets. They want to, this is simply a better way to find the papers that said that. That's what the Semantic Web initial use appears to be, and I've been working on it for 8 years now. And as far as I can tell, that's the thing that makes real scientists get really excited about this. In a science context, and again, humanity is very different. But, I mean, I spent 2 years trying to convince people to do this on Semantic Web. We actually had to go out and find funding to do it ourselves because the Semantic Web runs on open knowledge structures and you have to get them from somewhere. But we actually found that they're more valid from databases than from the literature until the publishers start selling us versions of the articles that publish directly into RDF. The articles aren't worth nearly as much as the databases. And that's why I keep arguing, sell us the RDF, give away the raw text. Because you can make a lot more money selling assertions that integrate directly into an electronic analysis system than by giving someone like me the raw text and two guys who are overworked to do text mining. Because, you know, 4 of the top 10 pharmas have downloaded our knowledge base in the last 2 weeks. Right? There's value to that open connectivity.
But it's, I think it absolutely has to work with publishers to tell us who said it, when, and how is it vetted.
Under the headline of university, I'm a little bit surprised that peer review has been largely left out of the discussion until now, because I think that's really a core thing where the university comes in, which is also very important for the overall publishing process. It's something that the university actually pays for. It's not the publishers that pay for the actual peer review process. And that's something that, what would the publishers do without the peer review process? I think that's really something that the university comes in at a very important. Because concerning respectable content, so to say, I think many people would agree that it's a core thing to that is the peer review. It's not the publishing.
I think it's an unfortunate misconception that publishers don't pay for peer review, and that's because publishers value tremendously the contribution made by the academy in the process of peer review, and it's indeed the case that, that the reviewers themselves are typically not compensated for that volunteer effort that ensures the integrity of the literature. But publishers do invest very heavily in the entire infrastructure for peer review. One analogy I like to use to outline that, and it ties, I think, to the discussion about universities buying back what they themselves have offered up, is think of the bottles of water we have here today. There's a lot of material that you could imagine can come out in the way of unfiltered water, and it requires work to do that filtration. And there's value to buying back that filtered, branded water. So the output of science is largely unfiltered.
I mean, but most studies show that the water in the tap is way better than the bottle.
That's a good analogy. Maybe so.
You have to recognize though, that the infrastructure that, that you're providing is changing, right? I mean, there's many free or nearly free software tools available that automate the process of peer review.
Understood. And the publishers rely heavily on this. So if I may finish. Publishers are investing heavily in the software systems themselves. They still value, though, the intellectual contribution of the academy. But I think we have a piece that's missing from the debate about the cost of peer review is, were reviewers to be paid, then the cost that would be incurred in terms of direct cost back to the library system under a reader-based model would be even higher. And that's relevant because under an author-based or stakeholder-based model, what one is going to end up doing is shifting the cost onto the producer of the information, which is an alternative business model. It's one that many publishers are embracing in terms of either hybrid or other fashion. But I wanted to illustrate the point because it means the net producers of the information will carry the burden for the output, which means the likes of Harvard, a heavy research producer, will carry that burden for that information for the rest of the world. Not bad. It's not a value judgment. It's just an observation.
Just a brief time. I think it would be still interesting to see in comparison, if you want to compare it in numbers, if you take the time that researchers take off for peer review, and if you take the percentage of the salary and add that up for the entire scientific publishing, and you put on the other side what the publishers are investing in peer review, I think there would still be it will still be clear what the core part of that is.
I mean, you're not saying that the publishers are doing any reviewing themselves. You're saying that they're doing the logistics.
Well, some publishers actually do manage the review process itself. They hire trained scientists and they engage in the actual process of the review. Nature is an example of that for some of their publications. And there are other examples of that sort. The majority of publishers of archival peer-reviewed journals rely on the scholarly expertise of the academy.
So when you say you're paying under review,
organized the systems and then the editorial talent, you typically expert scientists to manage that process. I'll give one example for Journal of the American Chemical Society. More than 9,000 manuscripts come into that journal each year. Less than half are actually published. 24 associate editors around the world work with the editor-in-chief, and we fund all of those editors and their offices to manage that evaluation process. And that is a combination of logistical support and, in some cases, honoraria. Now, that's the type of support that that scientific publishers typically provide to support the process of peer review.
So you're paying the associate editors for that journal
to manage the process of
9,000 submissions and 4,500.
Exactly. That's the peer
review. How much are they paid?
It varies by journal. And that's
so this was an example that you gave.
Yeah, so that varies by individual and by journal. It's not the sort of thing that we've discussed publicly in the setting of this one.
Well, but if you see it, it's pertinent because, of course, if you're talking about a cost per article of, $500 to $3,000, is $10 of that this, or is $2,000 of it? It's pertinent.
Yeah. Oh, okay, I can give you that sense. Overall, we publish about 30,000 articles a year, and the cost to publish those 30,000 articles all in is close to $3,000 per article.
And
the cost of the peer review part of that is more than half that amount, which tracks actually fairly well with the cost you hear from the open access publishers who are trying to recover their direct costs. But again, that varies across journals, etc. But I just wanted to stress that there's this unfortunate misconception of the community that publishers don't invest in peer review. They invest in it because they care. They really do want to maintain the integrity.
Maybe the issue is, you see, you're investing in peer review. The problem would be the terminology. I mean, when you say investing peer review, I would say what you're investing in is the logistics of the peer review, but not the peer review proper.
No one
argues that you should be paying peer review.
The evaluation by referees results in a recommendation to an editor. The editors are often supported and compensated. So I would say that's all part of the peer review process. Therefore, publishers invest in peer review.
I just want to restate Ann's point. So the question is not, is there an investment and is there a value? The question is, what's the right price point to pay for that?
And where should it be reserved?
Yeah, and you know, where should it come from? What's the right price point? Because the price points have been enabled to change radically through the network. And what we have here is sort of a negotiation process. And so where should that price be? What's the value? What's the real investment? What's the real value? And where should the price point come to? And that's going to happen as a result of the stakeholders, which are the institutions that host research, the people that produce research, the people that pay for research, the people that publish research. And so that's the negotiation. So they keep sort of beating that drum, which is, what's the role of university and library in the negotiation of that value proposition?
Yeah.
It seems to me that the person who would best be able to determine the value of the information would be the author himself. And yet this whole process that we've inherited from Gutenberg's time has evolved since then, and has become so entrenched since then, is one which is, where distribution and production are seen as two separate things. And the technology, although we don't have an example of it yet that really works, I mean, Wikipedia is probably the best example of a collaborative, globally accessible system. Yet it produces generally fairly average quality because it's not, it doesn't have like a diode to keep pushing up the quality to the expert level, to keep the level up there. But once we have an example of that, I think this whole discussion will start to change. That will be like the existence of blogging or wikis. This new technology will come along and we'll go, oh my god, this blows up everything.
So I don't think production and distribution have been separated. In fact, they're intermingled right now because in order for a professor or scholar to publish, right, it has to go through the peer review process, which is owned by the distributors, right? And the peer review process changes the bond, right? And also puts in stamp of approval and credential and status. And so in fact, they have not been separated, they're actually intermingled, right? And the question is, right, is that intermingling okay, right? And are there tweaks to the intermingling so that we can provide more access, right? Or is it that they should be fully separated, and that you know the production, the distribution side should be like a fab, right? Stuff comes in and they just print it out. It's not they shouldn't be involved in the peer review process, even though the majority of the peer review process is done by scholars themselves.
I mean, this still gets back to the idea of like individuals producing information. The information really comes from all over, from that experts community. And the peer review process has been separated artificially by the author gets to the point where he's ready to print it out, he sends it off to the publisher, then the peer reviewers all look at it, and then after a while it goes out to the publisher. But that whole process is slows things down. And the granularity is made much larger than really is what's optimal.
Right, because I think the system of the university rewards individual effort, right? So a 10-year process is based on your achievements. Right. With others, maybe co-authors, but it's singularly based on assessment of your quality and your ability to sustain and produce knowledge. So until we reject that system, which is another well-entrenched, you know, 1,000-year-old tradition, right? I don't think we'll get to the Wikipedia-based collective production of artifacts that we sort of see.
I agree with that to some point, but I think the problem is that the tenure process in many disciplines has been outsourced. In law, 99% of the journals are student-edited. Most of the scholarship is written by faculty. Publication is run by students. And the journals are all subsidized by the schools, who charge the libraries to buy them, actually, less than the full cost, so the subscription points are pretty low. And when somebody comes up for tenure in law school, it doesn't matter that much whether they're published in Harvard or Houston. The fact that they're still going to have to read the stuff and decide, you know, whether or not this is a good piece or not. And so it's been easy for relatively easy, I mean, it's a conservative field, but it's relatively easy to convince journal editors. Make your journals, you know, free on the web. Faculty like it because there's stuff that's out there. It doesn't slow down. Peer review process really comes later. It's an argumentative profession anyway, so the fact that one person says it's good and somebody else says it's bad doesn't matter. You know, you can argue about the law. It would be different if, you know, you had, you know, a doctor relying on whether or not this conclusion good or not, but you know, the bigger effect, it seems to me a bigger problem in the sciences is that the peer review thing hasn't been separated from the production. The validation, and a lot of the validation stuff is given over to the commercial world. We have to find somebody to do it, and so what do? They go to the universities and say, we need you on our editorial board so you can help us validate what's good, and that's, I mean, you don't get a lot, I don't think you get a lot of money for that, but you get a lot of kudos for that, so they're kind of using the economy of prestige, you know, suck the academy into a system that nowadays I think makes no sense. Publish a blog when you have a conversation, when you're done with your piece, you know, put it up if somebody, you know, wants to, and then, you know, separate the tenure process from that whole stream. Put your thing in an institutional repository and move on.
It's certainly the case that if the promotion process were completely different and were based on, which is, by the way, to a certain extent, I don't want to be looking cynical here. You know, I've sat on promotion committees and so forth, and we actually do read the articles. In the sciences, or it's not just, oh, it was published so-and-so in such place, or even worse, just counting the number of Tyler's documents was the most ridiculous. We actually do read the articles, but if it was widely acknowledged and universal, that that's how it worked. That the candidate could just submit a certain number of articles, and, along with whatever evidence there was that those articles were of use to someone. And you read the articles and you see if they're any good. This would have a big effect on how publishing works. There's no question about it. We have about...
That's if the audience is basically other scholars. If the audience is students, you know, where you want to get your work for students, either putting it in your course book or something, or if the audience is the general public, I mean, I think those are different markets to some degree.
Yeah. I just want to point out, we have about 15 minutes-ish to wrap up, and before we wrap up, I'm going to require that we collectively come up with our main points. I think it was three things three actionable items that we want to report to the main session. So let's just finish up a couple of questions people made. John, you had a.
Sorry, I just wanted to point out that I think people are really hung up on exactly what technology is chosen, exactly what decisions are made in the next year. I think that we can't expect a revolution as our model changes. That it's more these marginal changes, and that's what I think is most interesting, hearing about what's coming out with these Science Commons, the Creative Commons licensing, is that it's working with the existing institutions that are there, and that's something that I think the university can really offer, is in some ways a kind of objective stance, an opportunity to mediate between the publishers and the scholars and all the different people that are adding value now, that we may have better in 15 years, we may have a better way of doing things, but right now we need to be discussing marginal changes.
Right. So this gets exactly to these actionable items. So what I'd like here is very specific, concrete, short proposals for what actionable items the university could make along these lines. John, and then...
I'm going to list my wish list is self-archiving mandate in compliance with the NIH access policy or the long trust policy. Most publishers have found a way to work with this already, but it's a matter of normalizing so that it's not just a PDF version. We need the right to actually have this in XML so we can do some cool scientific stuff with it. Second is, this is a broader point, is I believe fundamentally in the two points that are made about semantic web and networks taking over and changing everything. But I think it's important to be realistic, which is semantic web is like web 1992. It's a long way from Wikipedia and blogs. And there needs to be an investment in getting it to the point where the killer app can take over and sweep it away. Because science is hierarchical enough and stodgy enough that unless we get it to that point, it will be very hard for the network effects to take over. It has survived a lot of attempted network effects. So part of what I think an actionable item needs to be is to begin investing in the infrastructure for the semantic web, which means investing in the libraries. So, a self-archiving
media... What is it that you want to be structured according to the semantic web? You want articles to be available in a computer-readable form? Is that the idea?
Articles to be available in a computer-readable form, but libraries to have the resources to do things like provide persistent naming systems. There's all sorts of core technology infrastructure that we're having to invent on the fly and provide in a non-persistent format because there's no one else that has them.
So can you give a name?
I'd say increase investment in libraries. This would be my action of my own.
But not just in libraries generally.
In libraries' ability to provide technical services back to the community. Because Elsevier is going to be able to do this as soon as it makes business sense, but the humanities journals won't. Unless the libraries can provide the similar services. So we'll create a larger divide if we don't let the libraries provide some of these tools. Because as soon as it makes sense, Elsevier got onto the web. As soon as it makes sense next, they'll get on the semantic web. So invest
in humanities journals, by the way.
Sorry. Well, I mean, you take my point. I mean, society publishers, it's a digital divide that we can create. So I mean, there's two things that can be done right now. One is to mandate self-archiving. Two is to give the libraries the resources make that useful.
I would endorse the resources for libraries. I would modify the archiving recommendation to echo what Anne said about data preservation, access to the underlying data. I would phrase it more in the way of appropriate guidelines and resources to facilitate investigators complying with whatever funding agency. I don't think it's a university's role to mandate self-archiving.
frankly, I think that's an incursion on academic freedom. It's my personal opinion.
Yes.
I think change is not incremental anymore. It's not marginal. If the university's role is to ensure that it is, then it's doomed. And part of the things that ensure that there are marginal changes are peer review needs to be completely revamped. Study of peer review as a lost opportunity cost. How many breakthroughs were delayed or completely sidetracked due to peer review, the way it currently exists? I know several of us offhand. Nanotechnology, for one, for example.
Two points. One is revamping peer review, the other?
Is this notion that we have to nurture marginal change. This is a phase change. It's not a marginal or incremental change.
We should not nurture marginal change.
The university's got to get ahead of that, be in advance.
So look for big change. I'm writing these all down, not because I necessarily agree with them all, but. Michael, did you have? I can't remember who had their hand up. Yeah.
I didn't understand everything that was said in terms of self-archiving over there. But,
by John or by?
Both. Okay. So, but XML jumped out at me. What I'm most interested in getting from this is agreed upon standards for archiving. I'm not sure if that's what you're getting at. But the ability for computers to easily access information.
I took that to be part of this.
Yeah.
Standards that allow
in
interchange in some computer-readable way. Yeah. Other proposals, yeah.
Well, looking at going back to the remanding and peer reviews, I think there needs to be a call for active research to go on. We don't have the great base of research-driven content to help us make decisions. We've got a lot of anecdotal and stuff from publishers.
Other proposals on actionable items that, yeah.
How about a very well documented public statement of what the process actually is? Because we're learning, or at least I'm hearing from some of the publishers and some of the librarians about how the journal process actually works and how the peer review process actually works. And it seems to be something that's very important. There are a lot of, I get the feeling that there are a lot of pieces that are not obvious.
Documenting the process.
Yeah, it does seem like the library's got the central role here, because the scholars are all busy producing knowledge, and the library's where all the knowledge supposedly is going to be accumulated, right? So they're sort of like the library is doing the job that the scholars don't want to do. They're busy producing the knowledge, but how it gets distributed and processed really is drawing them away from what they really want to do, which is to produce knowledge. So,
just back to remember myself. We do participate in this process in other areas other than writing.
Yeah.
We do reviewing certain awards and
all that
kind of stuff.
But what I'm saying is that for the university, you know, if we're thinking in terms of like the university's work, it seems like the library is the place where that comes in as representing the university's role. It seems to me that's what people are saying, and that's what I'm hearing. So you could say that the library subsidized the creation of all of these specialized journals by purchasing subscriptions over the past 40 years, right? And they've created the scholarly publication system that we have now. So the libraries have to think about how they're going to subsidize the next wave, it seems to me, or the next phase or the next version of scholarly communication. They made this one possible.
You know. So what's the actionable item that the libraries should?
I don't know, maybe somebody can.
Yeah.
Support libraries.
For me, I'd like to see university either uphold or redefine how they want scholarly knowledge presented. Because that's, I think, the decision whether you need publishers to do that. Because whether you want them to make, to edit that material, to make it more readable, to typeset it, to make it presented and easy to read, and to have it reviewed in a particular standard. And in the general discussion, I don't know whether that's going to be important in the future or not, whether correct spelling is going to be an issue for the digital generation. So really, I think the university's role is to define how scholarly knowledge is presented.
In a certain sense, you're generalizing this point. That is, as long as we're looking at the process, let's look at all parts of the process, not just the peer review, but the quality
everything
control and
the
entire. Yeah, so maybe we can generalize this to at least review, maybe not revamp, but at least review the process as a whole to see what might be varied. Yes?
A very prosaic suggestion, which I've heard a number of times when people have mentioned the word manage as well as the question of the business model. We're asking the library to take on this responsibility. Mm-hmm. It sounds to me like there's a significant need for skills that are related to business and management skills. I don't think I've ever seen any community work without significant reported resources in managing that community. And it sounds like a few people in this group were kind of brushing off the idea, oh, it's just managing peer review, and peer review is where the real value is. But it actually sounds to me like what the publishers are saying is the real value is in managing that process. And I have some skepticism that a nonprofit is going to be very good at that without significant skill upgrades in terms of thinking about it from a business process. Unless you're at Harvard Business School where you run it like a for-profit, I think there is some possible need for training in that area.
Well,
and how to manage the actual process.
I've talked to lots of librarians and served on lots of library committees, and I can assure you there's lots of management and budgetary skill in the Harvard University library system.
Granted, but I mean, it sounds like it's a different process than what we talked about before.
Right. So the point is that again, investment in training for this kind of management in the library is that
for managing this process and getting that
to be a balance of budget. Just as a point of information, a lot of publishers are not-for-profit organizations.
Yeah.
I have a suggestion for some kind of resolution, which is a better relationship between publishers and universities and libraries to help identify the authors. So to help establish a single reputation for individual authors. So when I'm doing my lab work and I post it online on a blog or I make a comment on a blog, it's not taken as some anonymous person or scientist or who is that person talking about. It's not clear. So that the volume of my work and the peer-reviewed status of my last 5 articles, that can all sort of quickly be assessed in my comment. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So
you want to
a better relationship that helps establish people's identities between university publishers.
Going to be able to authenticate people.
Yes.
All of their roles, not
to,
just
to establish a strong roles. Reputation. For individuals, for researchers. I don't think that
so. Authentication.
There doesn't seem to be a clearinghouse for that at all. And sort of Wikipedia is sort of a truthy. Some. How do you trust it? It's okay.
Yes.
But
so. I mean, this is not with respect to the peer review process. Those aspects that don't go through peer review.
Exactly.
You have some kind of way of.
A lot of our discussion centered on the cost of peer review. It takes a long time, it's expensive, and peer review is necessary because you put it as validating the provenance of the data. And how do we speed that up?
So if you could identify people in their other online communications, you might be able to use that information to establish their reputation as well.
And connect it to the blogs, right?
Right.
So you want your peer reviewed articles, your blog comments, and your preliminary posts
right.
to all sync up around your identity.
Right.
So there's identity and provenance questions and URIs for individuals. And there's all this sort of infrastructure that needs to sort of sit in there to get at the provenance and the trustability of information.
Right. Yeah.
I'm just going to mention you tapped into a
fascinating area. Journal editors really lament the fact that identifying and securing the best possible referees to use as part of the peer review system internationally is a major challenge, and it's an increasingly challenge given the number of investigators from developing countries who are rapidly wanting to enter the traditional publishing systems and are finding it difficult to evaluate the validity of their work. And it's, so peer review really does mean that, finding qualified peers. So credentialing is very important.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
So what's the action item there? Some sort of authentication or
digital identity? That's what I put, authentication of your digital identity somehow to
it seems like we have a mission
to be able to aggregate aggregate these various types of communication.
Is it just digital identity, or is it
it's credentialing?
Right. So
true names. Bot has that tie in friend. How does that matter?
And there are all names and I have their
spiral site. Yeah,
it's not real numbers.
Can we bucket this into is some technical solutions that need to be worked on, and there's some policy issues? Right. So is there a way that we can sort of think about sort of this? The reason I'm saying it selfishly is that I'm going to leave the wrap-up session.
You what?
I'm going to leave the wrap-up session at the end of the conference. So I just want to get a sense that there's a bunch of technology issues, digital ID, persistence of data and people, but also a sense of bunch of policy issues that need to also be talked about.
Right, and so the policy things include self-archive and data preservation guidelines, thinking about revamping the process. I'll lump these two together, those are the big change. It's documenting the process.
There's economic, so the resources for libraries. They're social as well.
Which are the social?
Some of the social would relate to the last topic just discussed, the credentialing.
The credentialing, yeah.
Why don't we just do the three clearest stuff? How can we help anybody to say that we want the university to solve technical problems, policy problems, and economic problems? I don't say that's going to help in the wrap up, but we chose three,
We're gonna have to structure these somewhat, and given the time, you're gonna maybe have to deputize me to do that appropriately. But you do this at your peril, of course. I'll make an attempt, and there won't be three of them when all is said and done. That's okay. We do need to wrap up because it's time for lunch. Thank you all very much for coming. It's been very interesting for me. I hope it has been for you. I'll make an attempt to summarize this. I'll also be around here, I guess, because we're having lunch in this room. So if people want to continue to talk, I'm happy to continue to listen.
Thank you.